Hello, my name is Georgia Schaefer-Brown, and I am a student co-supervisor and project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. I had the privilege of working on our event, Boosting Human Capital in Africa, Why It's Needed and How to Get It Done, which will be delivered tonight by Professor Pascaline Dupas. Dr. Dupas is a development economist and professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University, and is here this afternoon to talk more about her work. Welcome, Dr. Dupas.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. So just to start off with, could you talk a little bit about what work you're doing right now, both in your research as a development economist and also as a professor, as sort of a high-level overview?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm a development economist, as you said, which means that I try to understand ways to improve the lives of people who live in poverty, in mostly in poor countries. And I also teach topics related to that. My appointment at Princeton is both in the economics department and in the School of Public and International Affairs. And so I teach students in the, in SPIA, the School of Public and International Affairs, who do masters trying to think through ways to go into public service and to government work. And so the teaching part is about how do you bring into policy making the evidence that's out there. And the research part is about generating the evidence, right? So they really go hand in hand, because from the research, we are trying to figure out solutions that can work. And then from the teaching, we are trying to make sure that these solutions can be, you know, usable by those who make the decisions. And so that's like a big overview, but that's how there are these two sides to my life that I both enjoy very much.
It sounds like you're pretty busy. Do you find that your two roles conflict with each other, or it sounds like they complement pretty well?
You know, they complement pretty well, and it's also, you know, one of the privileges that we have being in academia is that, you know, we are, you know, forever students. We learn every, you know, essentially every day, because the research frontier moves, and as we, you know, we are, you know, on that wave and learning every day, and so it's great to be able to also pass on that knowledge as we acquire it, you know, share it with the students. As it goes, so it's really very, very complementary, and also teaching the master's students is a great way to learn also and get back from the very folks who, you know, implement policies, because many of them have already worked before coming to the school, and so it's a two-way, you know, learning process.
Very cool. What originally drew you to this work, the development? Would you say economic development or development economics?
So development economics is a discipline,
okay,
and economic development is a focus of that discipline.
Okay,
and I guess, you know, what drew me to that, you know, I don't actually have a strong sense of when things really started coalescing around that topic. There is one moment early on in my life that I remember. It was when I was an undergraduate student. I worked as a research assistant for a professor who was on a commission, a WHO committee on the impacts of, what was it? I think it was 2000 or something like that. It was a commission to think about the role of health in economic development, but I forgot the exact name of the commission. Anyway. The point is, as my job was to help synthesize the literature that looked at this effect of the disease burden on economic development, and it was, you know, very eye-opening for me to realize how important that is. So to this day, a lot of my work has been focused not just on development economics, but on the role of health. So to this day, I still work a lot on health issues, because it's such an important part of people's you know, day-to-day life and well-being, but also it's an important factor in people's ability to reach their full potential.
Yes, I looked at your very long list of research papers and work that you've done, and it seems like you have done research in a lot of different, like in education and health. So one of my questions was, like, what concentration do you have the most in? But it sounds like health, is that correct?
Yeah, so I've done a lot of work on health issues, but I've also worked on, you know, as you said, education. Also, access to, you know, financial tools, governance, and it's because everything is somewhat interconnected, interrelated. And so when you try to understand, for example, the determinants of health, you realize that, you know, having access to better education, higher quality education, helps, you know, people having also a better way to address health issues. The quality of education, the quality of health services is going to depend a lot on, you know, the governance. So it's hard to disentangle all these things. And when you start trying to, you know, address one issue, you realize that it would be nice to understand all the other things that come hand in hand with that. So that's one of the other things that I love about being in academia, is that we can keep pushing on something. Like, you discover that there is, oh, this is very important. You know, this is the reason why people are not able to do this. It goes beyond this very specific initial sector I thought this was in. And we have, you know, the freedom to just, like, start moving in that direction and learn about that and go into that. So compared to, and at some point in my life, I considered just, you know, being in the more of an activist or, like, working for an NGO and just, but then I realized, no, I'm going to get frustrated if I do that, because I can't be, you need to have kind of a one mission type of mindset for that. Like, I want to work on this one domain and that's it. Whereas for me, it felt like, no, there's going to be too many interconnected challenges that people face that I want to be able to address when needed, with a multiplicity of approaches and also, you know, potentially discipline. So I'm an economist, but I learned so much from reading the work of scholars in other disciplines as well.
Absolutely. So going along with this interconnected aspect, I know that you studied philosophy as well as economics in mm-hmm. your undergraduate degree. How has your background in philosophy influenced your work today?
I mean, I know how it's influenced me as a citizen, but I think as a scholar, it's more about the type of questions that I want to address, the perspective I take on issues. I don't, you know, in a day-to-day of, like, the research, and, you know, a lot of what I do on a day-to-day basis is really about, okay, how can I be sure that, you know, this is the causal effect of that, and this is, like, you know, very scientifically rigorous. So that day-to-day is not influenced by the philosophy background, but the overall, you know, some of the, you know, the motivation, for example, for wanting to work on development issues, even though, you know, I come from a very privileged background by the mere fact that I was born in France. Why am I interested in, you know, the plight of folks, you know, who grew up in a very different context than mine? I think that's influenced by, you know, John Rawls, you know, under the veil of ignorance, you know, we would all want the plight of folks who are born in countries that are, you know, struggling with some conflict or some other issues, you know, to be worked on. So that's how I think it influences what I choose to work on more than, you know, how I work on these issues.
Okay. And as we talked about, you have studied a lot of different things in a lot of different countries across Africa. I saw a lot of Malawi, Kenya, Burkina Faso, and Ghana, I think you're working on right now. And at the same time, your talk tonight is discussing boosting human capital across all of Africa. But, I mean, as we know, as you know, there's many different situations, mm-hmm. circumstances, and also needs and priorities of different people in different communities. So in these policies for governments and for international organizations, how do you adapt those policies to the specific needs and priorities of individuals or communities?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and you're absolutely right that there is just no one-size-fits-all. There is no magic, or silver bullet that would just, like, do everything everywhere, you know, all at once. So everything is precisely about, you know, tailoring and understanding the context and, adapting things to the local situation. So my talk tonight is about, you know, in part about some commonalities in the challenges that the continent faced that come in part from the, you know, shared geography, you know, tropical climates, high disease burden, and some of the shared history of, you know, exposure to slavery and then colonization for the, you know, large part of the continent. But then, you know, in terms of what, you know, what to do about, you know, addressing some of the challenges, this is going to be really discussing the extent to which you need to do experimentation, kind of, when I say experimentation, it sounds bad, but like, you know, try things out to get to, you know, the version that works best for a given context. And I do think that there are some general insights and takeaway that can be had from, you know, a study in Kenya. You can learn something that's going to be relevant for Malawi, but it doesn't mean that it's like plug and play, and then you can show up in Malawi and say, okay, exactly what we did in Kenya, we're going to do identical. It means that, okay, we have some idea that this may work, let's try it in this context, and then we may need to tweak it, or maybe it's not going to work at all. But as we aggregate lessons from studies in various contexts, we start to get an understanding of, like, okay, what's most likely to work in this context, right? So I can't be sure, but I can start to narrow the set of possible things that I can try. And in particular, I can have a sense of how likely it is that something is going to be scalable in terms of being, you know, cost-effective enough, for example. And so when you start narrowing the set of possible things, it's also much more palatable for a policymaker if you say, okay, these are the options on the table, rather than say, well, we have absolutely no idea, we're starting from a blank slate. So that's how I think a lot of us in this field think about the fact that we have studies that are in very specific contexts, but we, you know, think hard about what parts of this context, you know, are comparable to others and what are more specific, and then from that we can try to anticipate where else it would make a difference. But then in any, when I provide technical assistance, if you will, to governments, the first thing is always to say, okay, this is what we know from the research in this other context. The first thing we have to do, you know, in your context, is to kind of like pilot, you know. And that's how you can get to something that really meets the needs of the population at the local level.
And how much... It sounds like very dynamic work, and like you're working with tons of different people, both like locals and then those in the government. How much do you use, I don't know if it's like qualitative feedback, but like talking to the people about what's going on versus numbers and like quantitative? How much is it qualitative versus quantitative?
So I use both, and in fact, you know, I like to say that if you do qualitative interviews with enough people, it becomes quantitative. And that's kind of what I try to do. But it really depends on the stage of a project. So a lot of, you know, I myself have, you know, very little imagination, or not very good at coming up with ideas on my own. So every single research project I have done is just based on conversations I've had with people on the ground, or just observation of, like, you know, some challenges. I mean, a lot of my work, for example, initially was on subsidies for preventative health products, and it all started from essentially an NGO I co-created with friends that was giving free bed nets to pregnant women in Kenya initially. And why that? Because while I lived in Kenya, you know, a friend of mine lost a child to malaria, and it was, you know, that was an immediate need that I could see, that not everybody had access to this tool to prevent infection. And I, you know, tried to harness, you know, the wallets of my friends back in the U.S. to like try to solve this at the scale I could do that. And then, you know, from then, you know, then so that was, you know, that was an immediate reaction to what I saw. And then trying to understand why isn't there more financing for this type of programs, and oh, there are these research questions that are not answered, and so people who have, you know, international organizations are not too sure how to do this, and so let me answer this question so that we have some evidence on the table that can help unlock some of this funding. So everything I do comes from, you know, some like qualitative observation discussions, and that's how, you know, hypotheses are formed as to what the potential solution could look like. But then to test the hypothesis and, you know, be sure that indeed whatever solution has arisen from this discussion and this qualitative work, you know, is going to make a difference, then we have to get into the more quantitative measurements. But even then, you know, there are like many things that you can measure, and some of them are much more amenable to a purely, you know, 0-1 type of question. Did you have, you know, diarrhea or not yesterday? And some are much more about, you know, how do you feel about things? And so even in a quantitative study where you have a survey, you know, with, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people, you can have, you know, open-ended questions. You can ask people, you know, to use their own words to tell you how they feel about something. And to me, it's so this part is always so important, because when sometimes, you know, the data looks like something is going on, but you're like, does the lived experience of people match that? Like, in their own words, would they confirm, you know, the, you know, kind of story I'm spinning based on what I see in this quantitative data? And so if I don't have some, you know, open-ended questions, and then I can see in the answers that the narrative that come out are very, you know, match what I see in the quantitative analysis, then I'm like, I'm not as comfortable, you know. So to me, these are two things that are so important and complement each other.
I think what you said about lived experiences is really valuable, especially given the historical context of Africa and development work in general. I think, yeah, that having those conversations is really important. I want to get a little bit into one of your research papers from 2015 on labeled cash transfers in Morocco, called Turning a Shove into a Nudge, a Labeled Cash Transfer Program, a Labeled Cash Transfer for Education. Which examined, from what I understood, examined the results on school participation when small cash transfers were given to fathers in poor rural communities. This caught my attention for two reasons. I've taken some development classes, and I don't remember talking about labeled cash transfers. I think a lot of what I've encountered are either conditional or unconditional. Mm-hmm. So that was really interesting. And second, my understanding was that in general, a lot of the findings show better results when cash transfers are given to the mothers. So I read the abstract and I was like, whoa, fathers? And then the fact that it sounds like you did a comparison also looking at mothers. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this research. Yes. Labeled cash transfers, your findings.
So, you know what, I am so glad you asked me about this, and just for the audience to know, this was not prepared because I had no idea what the questions were before. But I'm so glad, because I was just in Morocco in July to go back to this study and look at some of these very questions about mothers versus fathers. So let me give you a little bit of a background for this study so that you understand why we did what we did, and then what we are looking at now. So essentially, at some point, the Moroccan government was interested in introducing a cash transfer program. This was after, as you just mentioned, you learned in class, many countries in Latin America in particular had successfully put in place such cash transfer programs. They are typically targeted at the poor, and in many contexts, they were like conditional on kids attaining a certain educational level, or more generally being present in the classroom, you know, over 85% of the time. Sometimes there were similar transfers for health, but these had been, you know, quite successful in a number of countries in Latin America, and so it became kind of like an exciting area. So the government of Morocco was like, okay, we should try that. and they kind of reached out to my classes and myself to help them design a program, and they were willing to pilot to understand whether it was a good investment for them to do to achieve their goals of increasing educational attainment. So we told them, well, there are some trade-offs, because maybe if you make the transfers conditional, you're going to have slightly bigger impacts, but it's very costly to monitor, you know, attendance. And so I think it's, you know, we think it's worth trying it out, conditional versus unconditional. But then when we pitched to them the unconditional transfer, which is you just give money to people without any condition, they were like, no, we don't want to do that. This is for education. So the compromise we reached was that these transfers where you had to register your child in school in order to register for the program and start getting the transfer, but then there was no, you would continue getting the transfer even if your child dropped out or did not attend. And so that's why we decided to coin this term of labeled cash transfer. It did not exist before, but that because it was a cash transfer that's labeled as being for education, because you know that, you know, it's meant for you to be able to more easily meet the needs of schooling your child and provide, you know, the right clothes or books or pens or something like that. So that's why we came up with that term. And you know, I'm, you know, in hindsight, I'm very glad that we were able to try this type of program, because I think it's a very cheap way of making it salient to the parents that the government values education, thinks it's a good thing. One of the learnings from this paper was that when we compared those households that got this labeled cash transfer program to households who didn't get anything, the beliefs about the importance of education had increased in the group that got this transfer. So that's the way somehow it works, is that not only it gives you more income, so it frees up opportunities and kids can be in school more, but also it changes your calculation, because you're like, oh, okay, it's really something that that we should do. The government really thinks it's important, and that changes people's priors about the returns to education. Now, on the mothers versus fathers, as you know, just like you having read all this literature, we told the government, okay, typically these programs give money to women. And, you know, Morocco is a context where there's very strong gender norms, and women typically are not the ones who go to the market, especially in rural areas, and this program was in rural areas. And so the government was like, well, we don't know it's going to work, because the cash points where women in the households can get the transfers are going to be in the, you know, the marketplaces, but this can be like an hour away from the villages, and how are the women going to go there? And so they kind of like pushed back on this idea. So we, you know, instead, what we managed to convince them to do was to at least, you know, experiment and try. And so we couldn't convince them to just do it with women, but they were willing to let us do both and then compare. And so that's what we did. And then we found that actually it didn't make a difference in terms of educational success. So it just, both of them were effective, which is, you know, there are not very many studies that have compared the effect of giving to men and women. We know it works when you give it to women. From our studies, we learned that it also works if you give it to men. People tend to think that men are bad in development. It's like, oh, they're going to go and drink or whatever. But actually, all the evidence that we have to this point, not just from our study, but others that have looked at that, it seems like, you know, men are not that bad. And fathers are not that bad. They can also, you know, care about kids, which is great news. Anyway, so that's the story. But then, you know, what we discovered just a few months ago with my collaborators was that it turns out that and I mean, that we had known for a while that after the study, the government had expanded the program pretty much throughout the country. It was a very successful program. Everybody knows about this program this year. But what we didn't know until we just looked at some administrative data is that in the very villages where we had initially randomized, you know, because that's how we compared men and women. We had like some villages that were allocated, you know, transfers to women and some to men. It was randomly chosen which village was getting what. In those villages where women were getting the money during the pilot study, it was still women getting the money up to today, you know, 15 years later. Mm-hmm. Whereas when the government scaled up to the entire country, they gave the transfers to men. And in the villages where initially we were doing the study with men, instead with men. So I went back to Morocco in July because we were like, oh, wow, this is amazing. I saw villages for 15 years, you know, and we are talking about hundreds of villages. Women have been getting this cash in every couple of months. And maybe we can compare those villages to those where it's been, you know, the men getting the transfers and see whether this has kind of changed gender norms and attitudes towards women's autonomy, you know, girls' aspirations and things like that. So I'm in the process of, you know, looking for research funding to be able to do this long-term follow-up study. But in the process of being, you know, there this summer, we realized that the program has been revamped completely and it's been integrated into a new kind of bigger cash transfer scheme, not just for education. And so I was, you know, torn because on the one hand it's more cash for poor households, so that's great, in given what I know of the challenges that they face, I think it's a good program. But the label is gone, okay, because the education part has been like swallowed into a bigger thing. So the label is gone, and we thought the label did matter. And now it's only men. And so in the very villages where the women were just telling us how great it was to be getting these transfers, they've actually just lost access to it. So now no women get transfers anywhere in the country. And so if we are able to do this long-term study looking at the impact that the transfers to women had, maybe we'll be able to have evidence that helps, you know, countries down the road, you know, when they design such programs, really think hard about whether it should be men or women or leaving the choice of the household. Because right now it seems like this decision was made without evidence on what was going to make the biggest difference. And I think it's a missed opportunity.
Wow. So yeah, sometimes your research doesn't go as planned because the government makes a different decision, it sounds like.
Yep.
How was that paper received by the development community? Because it had fairly unique findings. What was the sort of feedback?
It was overall pretty good news because it meant, oh, you don't have, you know, the transfer themselves were relatively modest. We found that you don't have to monitor absenteeism. You can just make them, you know, labeled and you get the same effect. And households were, you know, using the money for school stuff. And so it was, I guess it's, you know, it was good news. It means, oh, this program can make a difference and it's relatively cheap. So it was very cost effective. So I think that was the main main punchline. And then I guess the part that we didn't learn too much about from the paper is the mothers versus fathers, because in the end, the transfers were kind of, you know, relatively modest. And then when we tried to look at whether it makes a difference in terms of what is consumed with it, we didn't really see much because they were just using it for their kids. So mm-hmm. It wasn't really, you know, in principle, this type of design could help you settle some of the questions as to how the intra-household dynamics work and when women have access to transfers, does it change, you know, their consumption patterns? Are they better able to invest in goods for themselves? You know, it speaks to some various theories of the households, but in practice our data and did not really help us make that much progress on that. So it was, you know, it didn't make a big splash when it came to this gender aspect. It was more on the practical aspect of cash transfers and conditionality or not. That's where it was more influential.
Okay. In the interest of time, I'm going to wrap up with a few final questions. The first of which is, what advice would you give to an undergraduate student interested in going into your line of work?
I would encourage them to take some time after college to maybe work with an organization or somewhere abroad and really learn about a context and maybe, you know, learn a new language so that they can have these conversations we're talking about that are so important, but just kind of like immerse themselves into, you know, either a geography or a domain, and kind of get the view from within, and then from that, you know, they'll have a strong sense of how and why they can do something valuable. That would be my advice. Yeah.
Absolutely. Great advice. What is, in advance too, of your talk this evening, what's one thing that you hope that the Dickinson and Carlisle community will take away from what you have to say tonight?
So I don't know where people stand right now. I don't know what people's priors are, what they know of the topic. So it's always a bit tricky to give a talk when you don't know too much about your audience.
Of course.
But one takeaway is that the narrative around, you know, development or the lack thereof tends to blame the victim. In a sense that people have this image often of countries in Sub-Saharan Africa as being rigged, you know, with corruption or, you know, dictators and, you know, not many great things. I think that people don't necessarily have a positive image of the continent. But I think first of all, as you said before, these are like 54 distinct countries, and so generalization is not a good idea. And secondly, there is a lot of, you know, historical reasons for why it's been particularly difficult for countries in Sub-Saharan Africa to emerge economically. And it's our responsibility as a, you know, international community to kind of like repair, if you will, for the damage that was inflicted on these continents throughout history and now with climate change being being disproportionately bad for the continent. And it's obviously caused by people here and in other high-income countries. So this is kind of a moral responsibility that we have to think about ways to kind of like repair this damage. And it's not charity, it's really reparations.
Wow, absolutely. I think it's horrifying how short of a memory some people have in regards to mm-hmm. Africa and issues facing certain countries in Africa.
Yeah, absolutely.
Once again, on behalf of the Clark Forum, thank you so much for sharing your time and your perspective today.
Well, thank you again for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.